Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nyga. Glad to have you all with us for the show today. Lots to talk about, as usual, including some breaking news, which we'll get to in just a moment. Let me introduce the panel. Of course, it's Wednesday, which means Reg Bluestein, a political reporter. I always say you're the lead political reporter because no one has more bylines than you do for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Thank you for being here, Greg.
Thanks for having me.
We across from you is Julianne Thompson, a Republican strategist, a longtime leader in Republican politics in the state of Georgia, founder of a Georgia Tea Party years ago, back when there was such a thing as a Tea Party, Julianne. It's been a while.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you here. Senator Elena Parent, Atlanta Democrat, is with us. Today. Thank you for being here, Elena. And joining us from the studios of our Macon office is Lori Johnson, political science professor at Mercer University. Hi, Lori.
Hi, everybody.
Hey, Lori, as we get set to go on the air, Greg Bluestein mentioned that you've got the Attorney General of the United States headed to your city tomorrow. Apparently, Jeff Sessions is going to be in Macon. Are you going to see him? Do you know about that?
I just found out about it myself as well. I don't know if I can clear my calendar for that.
Okay.
But no, I actually heard about people organizing in protest of his visit before I heard that he was visiting. So maybe that gives you a sense of how things are rolling.
Yeah, he's down there to talk about his the administration's efforts to crack down on violent crime, but there will also be a Deport Jeff Sessions protest right outside the courthouse there. So,
okay, well, it'll be interesting to keep a handle on that. Let me start with some breaking news, national breaking news that really does have a Georgia angle. The feds today announced an indictment of Representative Chris Collins of New York. It came down about 2 hours ago, maybe a little less. He's been indicted on charges of insider trading involving he was a board member of an Australian biotech firm, and he learned information about the firm that led him to, they were going public, I guess, and he learned that they were going to make this announcement. He told his son about it, so his son had an advantage in trading on the stock. And now both he and his son have been charged. Greg, it's interesting for a couple of reasons. Number one, Collins was the first member of the United States Congress to endorse President Trump. So there are people who are going to make something out of that, of course, I would think. But the other interesting aspect of this is anyone who remembers Tom Price's hearings when he was nominated to be HHS secretary will remember that one of the issues that came up was that Price had bought stock in the same Australian pharmaceutical company. He has not been charged in any way. And other members of Congress had bought stock as well. None of them are implicated in this. But it became an issue in his confirmation hearings because there were questions raised about, given his involvement in issues involving biotechnology as a member of Congress, how he was benefiting, the accusation was from his involvement with the company.
Yeah, the company was called Innate Immunotherapeutics, and Collins was a director of the company and one of its largest shareholders, and was pretty open about the fact that he was encouraging his friends, his family, and fellow Congress members to invest in this company. And one of the people he encouraged to invest in this company was Tom Price, and he disclosed last year during his confirmation hearings that he invested about more than $50,000, between $50,000 and $100,000 in discounted shares of the firm. Democrats question whether or not he got a sort of, you know, a sweetheart rate for it. And he said, I did not get a sweetheart deal, but that he paid the same price as some other special class of investors. And it became an issue in his confirmation hearings for about a week or two.
All right. So we don't really have any reason to think that he's going to be caught up in this. It's just of interest, right?
I think so. From what I understand about this, they were coming out with a vaccine or some sort of breakthrough treatment for multiple sclerosis.
I apologize for
and they
that
found
wrong.
Out that it was not going to be a successful treatment. And so that's when this all supposedly happened. But it's brand new news, just 2 hours old. And, you know, I'm going to leave it up to the justice system.
Yeah, I thanked for correcting me because I frankly just could not remember what that was, what the issue was. So we'll keep track of that. It is of interest. You know, one of the interesting things about this, I have to say, Elena, is the news broke and people immediately, and to me this says something about our polarized society right now, immediately there were people on the left saying, oh, you know, President Trump will pardon him. There's no question. It just strikes you, this is the world we now live in.
Mm-hmm.
The
yeah.
reactions are so polarized and so immediate.
Well, my reaction was, I wonder if he has to resign. Is it setting up for one of those close special elections?
Well, in fact, Lori, that is a significant question. He's in a very right. safe Republican district. He's been reelected. I mean,
how
this is
safe, though.
Well, that's right. What's safe these days? But Lori, there is speculation about whether he will be able to keep his seat in Congress. This is a very serious charge. It's going to be hard to imagine Chris Collins not having to step down. And then we do have another seat, Republican seat, that suddenly maybe could be in play, Lori.
Well, Menendez never stepped down.
Right.
So, I mean, there's a precedent that says innocent till proven guilty. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it certainly creates that potential opportunity. I mean, I think the question of how our representatives handle their stock investments in their portfolios and balance those with the public interest are questions definitely worth exploring some more. But that's even different than insider trading explicitly. It's just more of a question of conflict of interest.
Yeah, which is
better to have a blind trust.
Yeah, which is exactly right. What was the issue that came up during Price's confirmation hearings. All right, let's move on. Before we talk, there's been some developments in the governor's race today, Greg, and we'll turn to you on that. But before we get to that, there's another big story, Elena, that we saw develop overnight, and that's that District Court Judge Amy Totenberg has now issued an order in which she has made it clear she intends to review a request for a preliminary injunction filed by a number of voter groups who want her to stop the use of Georgia's machine vote, the voting machines, which have no paper trail in Georgia, which some of those groups believe are susceptible to hacking. And Judge Totenberg has now said, I will consider whether or not the November election should be conducted on paper ballots. That has enormous consequences for the state.
Well, this lawsuit that's having the cascading effect was filed about a year ago, a little over a year ago. And since then, the headlines have just grown more and more frequent about, you know, legitimate questions that exist about our voting system here in our state. I mean, we're one of, I think, only four states that use this technology. It's no longer supported by the company that generated it when we first put it into place 16 years ago. Our state landed in the Mueller indictment of the 12 Russians, which doesn't give anyone confidence. It didn't say we had been hacked, but it did say they were nosing around.
So they probed at least two counties.
At least two counties.
We now know which counties were.
We've got some really wild headlines. One of my colleagues, a Republican in the State House, I believe, is challenging the election results for his primary because all kinds of voters were given the wrong ballots, or like there's only 200 registered voters and
voted
somehow
in the wrong precinct.
Yeah,
I mean,
things are wrong. You know, there's just a whole cascade of stories. As a matter of fact, right near my district in DeKalb, one of my very astute constituents realized, or former constituents actually, when I represented North DeKalb in the House, realized that she was assigned to the wrong state house district. And she should have been in, I think, Scott Holcomb's district. And so, you know, these things are just, you know, basically the crisis of confidence has grown. And no one, you know, all these emails from when the 6.7 million, the voter list was pulled down with everyone's social security numbers and everything that happened. They were informed about it. Basically, one of the responses was sit down and shut up.
All right. So, but let's stick to what Judge Totenberg is going to have to deal with and get everybody to weigh in on this. Let me start with you, Lori. with 90 days to Election Day, Judge Totenberg is going to have to move awfully quickly here, because if she rules that we need to vote on paper ballots, that's an enormous burden on the state to deliver within 90 days, isn't it?
It is. You know, my first thought when you mentioned this story was, is she related to Nina Totenberg?
She is. She's her sister.
They are sisters.
Yep.
Yes, they are.
But yeah, so, you know, there's the NPR junkie in me. I think that, you know, in some ways it's a burden, yes, but remember, paper is the simplest way to go. And it wouldn't require new equipment. It wouldn't require new technology. And, you know, they're modern democracies in the world that still use paper. The biggest difference is the amount of time that it takes. But I think we would all agree getting it right is better than having it be quick. And so, you know, they'll come back with their concerns about the logistics and the burden and the costs. But ultimately, the task is to make sure the votes get counted correctly.
Julianne, we are one of a very few states that don't have a paper trail anymore.
I understand. And from I have not looked in detail at the ruling, but from what I understand, she actually put the onus on the plaintiffs and said, prove it to me that this can happen. She's not saying to the Secretary of State's office, you need to prove it can't happen. She's telling them to prove that it can. So the responsibility
should be on the plaintiff. That would be standard in any lawsuit.
So in that case, I just think that they're going to have a difficult time proving that it's going to be inexpensive and logistically possible in the amount of time that we have between now and November.
Yeah, I mean, this is a tough one. Judge Totenberg said that she has to look at what she calls the practical realities of doing this.
Right.
And we already had this debate earlier this year in the Georgia legislature where it would cost tens of millions of dollars to update the entire voting system. It seems like we have a consensus from both parties that the voting system needs to be updated in some form or fashion. And even Brian Kemp has said that they should be phased out after this year's election. But after this year's election. So doing this sort of change 90 days out from a nationally watched election and finding some sort of physical means to do this would be really, you know, it seems like high ledge.
The other flip of that coin is that the reason I was going through that litany of headlines and examples is because the crisis of confidence
right.
has grown to very large proportions, and that's also a problem.
That what's interesting or important about that, I think, Elena, is there's bipartisan concern. It isn't as if, now, this has been politicized because, of course, there are Democrats who are attacking Kemp as the gubernatorial candidate for, they say, not overseeing our election apparatus in an appropriate way, that he's been lax. And some of the things that you mentioned have been used against him, perhaps fairly. Regardless, Lori, there is at large a bipartisan concern that we can't trust our elections anymore. And it's not just here in Georgia. It's in other states as well.
Well, elections have always been messy. It's just we don't notice it unless the elections are close. And then when the elections are close, as we saw with the 2000 debacle in Florida, then we see how messy they really are. And hopefully we could learn from that. But, you know, there's no question elections are going to be closer now. And that definitely puts the magnifying glass on how those votes are counted and how registration happens and purges of voters and all those things.
And we saw that sort of manifest itself this week in the calls for Brian Kemp to resign by Georgia Democratic leaders. And, of course, Kemp said he's not going anywhere. But we heard DuBose Porter and Max Cleland, former U.S. Senator, who was also a former Secretary of State, sort of echo those calls, saying that with the concerns about the voting process, should we have the state's top elections official also be on the ballot to run for the state's top office?
Julianne?
Well, Kemp was Secretary of State when he ran for election in 2014, ran for re-election. He was on the ballot. Massey and Cox were both Secretary of States when they ran for higher office, and we did not hear that call from Democratic leadership at that time. I think that the timing of this is so suspect, it's comical.
Well, it's the only thing, I mean, everything you just said is absolutely correct. We have seen secretaries of state run for re-elections that they were overseeing. We've seen secretaries of state run for higher office. Kathy Cox ran as a primary candidate for governor when she was secretary of state. So it happens. But again, Greg, this comes back to the sudden particular concerns. We have suddenly got it in our minds that election apparatus can be manipulated, that it can become a partisan issue, and perhaps, but of course, at the same time, Julianne's right. This is all fodder for the Democrats to attack their opponent in the race.
I mean, yeah, everything's been politicized now, and the election process itself is politicized, and part of the reason too is you've got two people with a central role in voting rights in this state running against each other, who have been long before the governor race really heated up. They've been rivals over this issue for years. Stacey Abrams and her New Georgia Project, and Brian Kemp being the state's top elections official, have sparred for years over how the New Georgia Project has worked to register voters and other voting rights issues. And so, you know, any doubt that voting rights wouldn't be front and center in this campaign has quickly gone away.
Well, Kansas hasn't even been called yet. And Kobach, who is Secretary of State in Kansas, the Democrats in Kansas are already doing the same thing to him.
Sure.
So
sure.
This is
well,
political.
Brian Kemp should just, he's not going to be in the office much anyway. He should just very publicly tap somebody who is the day-to-day. And of course, that person would exist anyway, and it wouldn't go. It wouldn't mean that that every Democrat in the state would stop having concerns.
I do think,
but it would help.
But let's be intellectually honest here. The Secretary of State oversees elections. They do not administer elections. That is done locally. And to call into question all of our local elections officials and their ability to do their job, I think, is not just suspect. It's intellectually insulting all of them.
Yeah, but one of the problems is all these, you know, white hat hackers. I mean, they found very easily on our system repeatedly. And the holes were not patched. They found all the passwords to just go in and change results. You can't really blame people for saying, hey, they've known about this. They did nothing. And these are actually keys with no paper trail to undoing the whole thing.
Let me jump in. I am not a political consultant. I only play one on the radio. But, Lori, it does seem to me what Elena's saying has some merit. If you're Brian Kemp, and there are people, and you're getting fired at over and over again on this, why not just be proactive and say, I'm going to, just to make absolutely certain, and because I am so busy on the campaign trail, it does make sense for me to turn over this election. I'm going to let our independent career elections officers oversee this election. Why not? It's not really changing much about his role. It just seems to me to take an issue off the table for Democrats, Lori.
Well, and it's an issue that his opponent in the primary also harped on, his ineffectiveness and incompetence in that role, too. I mean, that's the only downside I can see to that decision, is that, you know, his statewide office is what his experience in that statewide office and management of it is part of what he's running on.
Julianne,
that's not good for him.
Julianne, you had an expression of distaste when I made that comment.
Well, but because I felt like that I made that point earlier when I said that elections officials are already the ones administering the election.
Okay, yeah, you did.
And he probably, I mean, he hasn't said it publicly, but there probably is someone who's handling the day-to-day in his office. And Kathy Cox told me the other night, because I asked her about this issue Monday, and she was the Democratic Secretary of State who did not step down, but she said she might have had she won the primary, but she didn't get that far in 2006. But she said she had an assistant Secretary of State handling the day-to-day issues then, too, because she was so much on the campaign trail.
All right, I'll tell you what, let's do this. Let's get a break out of the way. We've already mentioned briefly the returns of a couple of big elections that we were watching around the country last night. And let's talk about those in a minute, but let's specifically talk about them in terms of how we think they might tell us something about what to expect in Georgia as the race here unfolds. You're listening to Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
Peter Sagal here, and if you're in your car, I want you to try something. Roll up the windows. You're all sealed inside. Take a good smell. Can you smell that? That was the great cologne experiment of 2004. You should not have gone with the dollar store for that one. Well, you can lose that old car smell by donating your vehicle to one of your favorite causes, like public radio. It only takes a few minutes, and just like that, you've supported this station, and well, you are on your way to a life of better smells.
Go to gpb.org/cars and thanks.
We're back on Political Rewind. Laurie Johnson, political science professor at Mercer University, joins us from our bureau in Macon. In the studio, Julianne Thompson and Elena, Senator Elena Parent, and AJC reporter Greg Bluestein. The two races that we were watching particularly closely, of course, Greg, the big one, the Ohio 12th, where they had a special election for a Congress, a seat that once belonged to John Kasich and has been held by Republicans since 1980, a district that President Trump won by 11 points. Democrats actually thought they might have a shot at winning this thing. With Danny O'Connor, kind of a centrist Democrat. He ran as a centrist, as a guy who'd work across party lines. And a fairly uninspiring, as Republicans said, opponent, Troy Balderson, who didn't raise a lot of money. He was not great on the campaign trail. Trump went there last Saturday night. What a big deal that the president of the United States felt that a guy in what should be a safe seat needed a visit from him. And it turns out right now, it looks like the president's visit and the $5 million that Republicans put into that race was worth about 1,700 votes. Because that's the margin which Balderson seems to be winning the race.
Yeah, and he's declared victory and Trump has declared victory. There's still some provisional ballots out, so there's still a question. But
1,700 votes,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, it's a pretty decent margin. And Mike Pence is coming out there, I think, tonight. But it shows you Republicans are, you know, did their best. And it wasn't just the, you know, the Trump, I guess, the Trump wing of the party. It was also the governor the Republican governor gave a very a lukewarm endorsement.
Last minute, Kasich jumped in.
Yeah. Kasich got in. So, of course, he's not a Trump fan. And so, you know, one of the most interesting takeaways of this race, though, was the suburban rural split there. One of the analyses I read showed that in the fast growing suburban part of the district, there was about a 42% turnout. In the more lightly populated rural parts of the district, it was closer to 27 to 33% turnout in those counties. And a lot of Republican voters in both those areas, of course, especially in the suburbs. But it does show you that, you know, the close in suburbs in Ohio and some of these other districts are coming out to vote, and that's going to be key to this election too here in Georgia. Of course, the 6th and 7th districts are literally close-in suburbs, but also the statewide elections could hinge on areas just like those.
You know, one of the things that I thought was so interesting about watching this race, Laurie, is this is really this is a district that actually has some Democrats and some Republicans. Although it's been a Republican, a safe seat for Republicans for decades, there's a lot of Democrats. And what the heck? Why hasn't gerrymandering taken hold in that district, Laurie?
Right. Well, and, you know, I think the rural-urban is a good point. Women voters are going to be important to look at here, and education. And, you know, Kasich, even though he came out and supported the Republican candidate in the end, also said that the reason the district was in play at all was because of Trump. That, you know, it shouldn't have been close, but it was the alienation of suburban voters and women that put it in play to start with.
All right. So then with that in mind, let me get from the Democrat and the Republican in the studio today your takes on what the implications of this race are for Georgia in the fall. Julianne, you go first.
Okay. Well, first of all, let me say, in addition to what John Kasich said about the area not being, you know, the biggest fans of Trump, the candidate Balderson also had a major gaffe on the campaign trail about a week and a half to 2 weeks ago.
Yes. He told voters in one county, why would you want to be represented?
Why would you want to be represented by someone
in Franklin County?
Right, which is Columbus, which is the urban area. So, I mean, I don't think Balderson was that great of a candidate. I mean, he was not very exciting. He was not relatable and full of gaffes. And, you know, the Democrats had a good candidate. he had a they had a likable candidate, and they had somebody that was running to the center promising to work with both sides. They haven't gone in the direction of many other candidates that were connected with Bernie Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez. They had a bad night last night. Anyone connected with Sanders lost last night.
Yeah, that is certainly one of the other things that happened. And I don't want to get too far away from implications for Georgia, but yeah, liberal Democrats that were cheering after Ocasio-Cortez surprised everybody in New York got shot down across the country last night.
And I'll segue that into Georgia. Bernie Sanders did endorse Stacey Abrams, and she has tweeted pictures of herself with Linda Sarsour. Both are members of the Democratic Socialist Party here in the United States. I mean, that is something that does not fare well with centrist Georgians. And I think that as we get closer to the general election and more of that information comes out, I just don't think it's going to fare well.
So, okay, Elena.
Stacey Abrams is not anywhere near a Democratic Socialist.
I said she associated herself with them. Yeah, Bernie Sanders did endorse her.
Yeah, but so did Hillary, who did a robocall for her. Everybody.
And she posted a picture of herself with Linda Sarsour.
Well, I don't even know who that is. And I'm an elected Democrat, so let me tell you, she's not a household name.
And real quick on the source, I don't know if she posted the picture, but the picture certainly is circulating. She's
an activist on behalf of Palestinian causes. Yeah. She's a Muslim woman. The picture shows her. She wears a hijab.
She's also a leader of the Women's March.
Yes. And anti-Israel.
And she is, she's very public about her issues with Zionism and Israel. And I asked Stacey Abrams, this is a side note, but I asked Stacey Abrams' campaign about that picture because I started seeing it all over the weekend, and she said she does agree with Linda Sarsour on issues, Women's March issues and women's rights issues, but that is about where it ends.
But here you're hearing it, Elena. Julianne is laying out the ground game for how Republicans, regardless of the suburban women who went to bat for Danny O'Connor, voted Democratic in a Republican district in Ohio. The Republicans are going to make this race to the best of their ability about the fact that they say Stacey Abrams is a Democratic Socialist.
Well, I mean, that's funny. Anyone who's worked with Stacey Abrams throughout the years knows that's blatantly untrue, that, you know, they can try it. But I don't know. I mean, Stacey Abrams has never once indicated any leanings in that regard. And anyway, why should she? As we already noted, that wing of the party was not performing well, which I'm actually pleased about because I would like to see more centrist candidates because I believe that the government should actually be capable of governing.
You don't want to embrace Cynthia Nixon, who is running, of course, against the incumbent governor of New York there, and who went to the Netroots Nation conference a couple weeks ago now and said, the Republicans are going to call us socialists anyway, so why don't we just embrace it and
there was a really interesting op-ed in the New York Times about capitalists. Why do you think there is a rise in socialism? Look in the mirror, you know, saying, like, to someone Ocasio-Cortez's age, she's 28, look what's happened in those decades since her birth.
Right.
Like, why would you think? But here, but can
go
I get
ahead.
Back?
Yes, of course.
But read it, though. It is really interesting because it rang really true. This election is interesting because there are, 68 other seats that are more favorable to Democrats just based on recent electoral performance than this seat in Ohio. And they did have to fly in the president and I think the VP too and spend $5 million. That's not something that you can do easily across the country when it comes to November elections.
All right, how do you think it's going to play here in Georgia?
So the suburbs are more highly educated voters. Are just extraordinarily uncomfortable with Trump and the direction that he's taken the Republican Party in. I personally believe, and I've said numerous times, that the damage he's doing not only to American institutions, but more specifically the Republican Party, may take many decades to undo. So the point is, these seats that are going to be closely contested are suburban seats, and it was close enough when Ossoff was running. So, if I was Karen Handel and Rob Whittle, I'd certainly be sweating.
I mean, one of the other big takeaways from this election is it continues to trend. Republicans have lost support in every special congressional election since Trump took office. In Ohio last night, it was a 36-point gap. In Georgia, we saw, I think, double digits. In some districts, it's been very minimal, and one Texas district was only 1 point, and yet still that trend continues. what we haven't seen in Georgia and we won't see in Georgia is, any, I don't think, are any Republicans running away from Trump. And certainly not Brian Kemp. And Brian Kemp is, I think, banking on a Donald Trump visit near the end in order to even more energize his supporters.
Laurie, how do you see, as a political scientist, what you watched unfold in Ohio? How do you imagine it relates to Georgia, if at all?
Well, I mean, I think it's always difficult to draw conclusions, even this recently after an election, but transfer those to congressional districts in other states. It's all guesstimation in that sense. But I do think some of the themes that are emerging are not unexpected ones and will be continued. I mean, you know, in the Ossoff race here, Pelosi and the demonization of Pelosi and who she represents, that was an issue in the Ohio race. It's going to continue to be an issue here. I don't quite understand why it works as well as it does with Republicans, but that's something we're already seeing with Stacey Abrams tying her to Nancy Pelosi, too.
Well, we're talking about special elections here, like Greg mentioned, and I think that we've talked about this before on this show. It is who has the most motivated base that will get out the first week of school in the summer to vote. And clearly, Democrats were motivated, but there's going to be a much larger pool of voters come November. And I think that things are not going to be quite nearly as close in the 6th and 7th as they've been in these special election races. And I maintain that Rob Woodall and Karen Handel are going to be safe. But we need to campaign like we're behind.
And we're seeing a lot of the same tactics and strategies we saw in last year's special election with John Ossoff and Karen Handel being used all over again. And probably, I think the answer, Laurie was asking earlier, why Nancy Pelosi keeps on popping up is because poll after poll, and we did one last year asking her approval rating among Republicans, and it was something like 4%. It was 80%. Yeah, but
I wasn't questioning why she's coming up. I'm just questioning why it works so well.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't understand. I mean, I know she's a woman and she's from San Francisco. And
yep, that's it. You just hit the nail on the head.
And so the first RJ ad.
Kind of.
I'm sorry. I was saying the first RGA ad for Stacey Abrams,
Republican
Governors, showed Stacey Abrams sandwiched between Nancy Pelosi and Hillary Clinton, another person who doesn't quite poll very well with Republican voters.
All right, by the way, we're going to turn to the GOP race for governor of Kansas, where you have an incumbent governor who is an appointed governor. He filled out the term of Sam Brownback, who left that seat. And here's another race like the Georgia GOP runoff where the president decided to insert himself. He went to bat. He endorsed Kris Kobach, who is a controversial figure. I think most people would call him pretty far to the right. He's vehemently anti-immigration. As people will recall, the president appointed him to be the head of this commission, voting commission, that was supposed to find 3 million votes that were cast illegally. That didn't go anywhere. And Republicans in camp, Bob Dole and other mainstream Kansas Republicans came out and said, please don't vote for him. Well, again, in that race, the president's endorsement was worth what we now think is around 200 votes. That's the margin in that race right now. And Tom Faust just sent me a note from The Hill that relates to our earlier conversation, Julianne. Kobach is saying he will not recuse himself from a recount in that race. He is Kansas Secretary of State. Yes.
Yes.
Your reaction?
Well, the margins are so close here. I mean, it's exactly 191 votes, I believe, over Cloyer. How do you pronounce his last name? I don't even know.
But Trump is not. My point is, Laurie, and Greg already made this point. Trump has shown enormous power in GOP. I mean, when he comes in and endorses, as he did, Brian Kemp in this race, he's like 9 out of 10, 10 out of 11. I mean, he's had incredible success. But on the other hand, in these special elections, where he is a more incendiary character, Laurie, he may drive the passions of the Democrats as much as the Republicans, yes?
Oh, I think that's absolutely the case. And I think that, you know, even though the special elections are different I'm sorry, I can't always follow the voices, who's who, but as you were saying earlier, the general election has its own dynamics. It's much more on the radar of everybody. It's going to be something that, you know, people will be talking about more. And, you know, there's no question the loyalty of his base to this president is something that is distinctive and new. But he makes no effort to expand beyond that base and, in fact, makes efforts to actively demonize anyone not in that base. And I just can't see how that's a good long-term strategy for winning elections.
Greg,
because 35% is not enough.
That was my point earlier when I said he was doing long-term damage.
I think right. He has expanded beyond that Republican base. I mean, if we're talking about Reagan-type Democrats that crossed over last time to vote for him, if we're talking about a lot of unions that crossed over to vote for him, and some of his policies that are not traditionally Republican policies that are more pro-union type policies, like with regard to the tariffs. And I think he has managed to bring in a lot of new blood.
But, Greg, as you've pointed out, that was certainly true in 2016. There's no question about that. But as you've pointed out, as you look now at the pluses and minuses in terms of benchmarks of where voters were in 2016 and where they are in 2018, Democrats are making much bigger strides than Republicans are across the board, even when the Republican wins whatever the election is.
They are, and Trump is bleeding some of those voters he won over in 2016. And some of the Democratic losses by more narrow margins show that, but also some of the Democratic wins, like in Connor Lamb's district. I know he was a very, you know, potent, very powerful candidate. But still, he won this suburban Pennsylvania district, the exact sort of district that Obama won and that Trump won in 16, and that it could be a key to the 2020 election.
Here's how the 538, which, by the way, I recommend to everyone because it's a terrific website for people who like to crunch numbers. Here's how the 538 positioned that Ohio 12th district result. It was just a 1% point Republican win. We know that, or we think it's a win. That district is a 14-point partisan lean for Republicans traditionally, which means that the Democrats overperform by 13 points in the district. That's fairly close to the national average, where Democratic overperformance is up like 16 points in the federal special elections that have gone on since Trump was elected. That's data.
And you need plus 7 to take back the House.
So, I mean, it is true. But I don't know that Georgia, Julianne,
no, we absolutely,
is the same.
Exactly. I agree. We have to work extra hard, obviously, in the Midwest and some of the other parts of the country. But I just don't believe when it comes to the 6th or the 7th that we're going to lose either one of those districts. Now, are they going to be national in nature? Is the media going to be here? Are the Democrats going to try? Of course they are. And that is why we need to work like we're behind. However, I believe that both Rob Woodall and Karen Handel are going to be safe in the long run. And I live in the 7th district. And I know that people are constantly saying it's changing demographically, it's changing economically, socioeconomically. It is to a point, but just because something changes demographically doesn't mean it changes socioeconomically. And if you look at the 7th district, we're talking about Suwanee, Sugar Hill, Duluth, Buford, and part of Lawrenceville, and we're talking about Cumming. Forsyth County is extremely Republican, and I just don't believe that the 7th has any chance of going blue.
Greg,
well, I think that even if they can hold on this time, these are the very type of districts, though, that Republicans have been are in serious hot water with, and that won't change unless something changes at the top of the
Greg, or the districts
level.
Change in yeah. 2020 when they redraw.
Well, they're going to have to give one of them up, probably.
Yeah.
Well, I think the point, too, I mean, electoral policy is not my field. I think of this just like Elena was saying in terms of governance, that, you know, the question of how we govern after these elections are run and the way they're being run and the closeness of them is a serious issue. And, you know, it's not just who wins or loses, but how are they going to be able to govern once they're in there?
All right. This is a conversation that is going to play out between now and November 6th, and we will keep talking about it on Political Rewind. I do want to get into talking about where the race, some of the events, mm-hmm. Greg, and I'll turn to you on this. We're going to get to a break first. Just what happened in the governor's race between Brian Kemp and Stacey Abrams over the last few days, and what should we make of what's been happening? We'll do that after this message.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Jennifer Fox about writing and directing the Emmy-nominated HBO film The Tale, based on her experience being sexually abused at age 13 by her running coach. It took her years to realize that the story she told herself then, that this was a relationship based on love, was really a story of child sexual abuse. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
Greg Bluestein, it's now been a little over 2 weeks since Brian Kemp won the runoff to be the Republican candidate against Stacey Abrams. What's going on these last couple of days? What are you following? What's going to be in the paper tomorrow morning?
We only have 90 days left until November. A couple of big things. I mean, we were following the general overall tone of the race, and you talked about it a little bit this week, but Stacey Abrams is relying on surrogates, her allies, to really do the biggest damage against Brian Kemp while focusing on the issues she wants to focus on. Well, Brian Kemp is and his allies, too, are attacking Stacey Abrams, calling her liberal, who is on the, a radical, who is on the path to socialism. And we have some of our bigger outside groups spending a lot of money on ads this week, including the Republican Governors Association with their second ad. And this one spotlights Stacey Abrams' fiscal issues, her debt to the IRS, and her loan to the to her own campaign.
Well, while you mention that, why don't we listen? You were at an event with Stacey Abrams late this morning. It was an education event. She was talking about her education plan.
You got it.
But the question, and it may have come from you, she was asked about the newest charge from the Kemp campaign, which is that they're saying if it's not illegal, it should be, mm-hmm. that Stacey Abrams is in debt to the IRS and yet was able to loan her own campaign $50,000. Let's listen to how she responded and then talk about this.
My conversation about my taxes has been public. The IRS and I have an agreement. I'm on a payment plan. I have never failed to file my taxes. I have never failed to pay my taxes. I'm on a payment plan to fully fund my taxes. And I will tell him as I will tell anyone else. I could not defer my family's needs. I could defer paying my taxes, and I am paying them. The IRS and I are in good standing, and I would argue that the focus should be on what will be done for Georgia and not my conversation with the Internal Revenue Service.
So Julianne Abrams essentially says, wait a second, I have a payment plan with the IRS. I am making good. I'm on good standing with them. That doesn't mean all my money has to go to them. This is a fake charge. Your response?
Well, it's not a fake charge. I mean, first of all, a lot of people are on payment plans with the IRS, no doubt about that. But at the same time, they didn't loan themselves the amount of money that they owe the IRS, so to their campaign. So that is what the difference is. It's one thing being on a payment plan. It's another thing being able to come up with that money to loan it to your own campaign for governor. And I think that that is why that particular RGA ad, although it is biting, it's true. And I think that it's going to be effective.
The bigger, I suppose, issue, it seems to me, and so I get why the Republicans would use this, but it seems to me that the bigger issue that they're trying to raise is if you can't trust that she's handling her own finances correctly, how do you think Stacey Abrams would do running the finances of a $20 billion-plus economy of Georgia? That's certainly what is at the heart of all this.
Elena. I mean, Governor Deal had severe financial problems when he was elected. Trump has had numerous bankruptcies. Brian Kemp messed up the Secretary of State's office. It's been charged by people on both sides of the aisle. So, you know, I don't know. I think a lot of Americans since the Great Recession are familiar with You know, they say most Americans would not be able to cover a surgery or a new refrigerator.
Which is exactly.
So, you know, it's just, I just wonder how effective it actually is outside affluent circles.
I apologize for not bringing, but that's exactly, Greg, what State Senator Josh McCoon, yeah, a Republican from Columbus, was trying to say when he put out a statement, I guess by Twitter, telling Republicans, stay away from these finance issues. Lots of people are struggling financially. You are not going to win on this. Stacey Abrams is going to make the case that she's one of the people trying her best to make her life whole.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what he said. He said the people already see the Republican Party, the critics of the Republican Party see them as the party of the millionaires, so let's not feed into that argument, which is why I'll add the RGA and Kemp's campaign isn't attacking her purely on the fact that she owes debt to the IRS. They're saying she owes debt to the IRS, but then loaned her own campaign that's about that same amount.
Right.
I think they were in
startup mode. Well, that's like saying somebody with...
Sorry. Go ahead, Lori. Go ahead, Lori.
I was just going to say, it's sort of like saying to somebody, well, you have credit card debt, so you can't take a vacation. I mean, you know, if she has a payment plan in place and she's paying on it, she gets to decide what she does with the rest of her money.
Okay. But she's used it to run for governor. That's not taking a vacation. She's avoiding paying something that she owes to the government and instead taking that money and loaning it to herself to run to be the highest elected official of Georgia government.
All right, so we hear...
No, she's not avoiding it. She's paying it, and she's investing in...
Well, but she had the money to pay it that she loaned to herself.
So we hear how this is going to play out.
Like a credit card.
We hear how this is going to play out. We get it, and we'll go from there. But I want to go back to this notion, Greg, you mentioned, the tone of the campaign. We have talked about it on the show, but we have in front of us two individuals who were quoted in, I think it was Your Piece this week, on exactly that.
I did that on purpose.
Abrams herself, as we've pointed out, has chosen to focus on issues. She's made glancing references, negative references to Kemp. She went on the air with Trevor Noah the other night and talked about one of the great vote suppressionists.
The architect of voter suppression.
Yeah. But she has not gone after him the way that he has gone after her. And Elena Parent and Julianne Thompson were both quoted in your article about the difference in tone. What did you say, Elena?
Well, I said that she was, you know, introducing herself to the broad audience as sort of the adult in the room. She didn't run absurd, you know, ads. You know, during the primary, Kemp was obviously beat up badly by Cagle. So Abrams has had the luxury of being able to introduce herself by saying, these are my ideas. I'm focused on attacking problems. You be focused on attacking people and all of this nonsense. But I'm going to demonstrate how I can make life better. My ideas will make life better for all Georgians.
What did you say, Julianne?
I said she can't run away from the facts, so she's not addressing them. And the fact of the matter is, earlier when I talked about her connection to Bernie Sanders and Linda Sarsour, I wasn't trying to frame her as a Democratic socialist. I am speaking to judgment here and discretion. And when you combine that lack of judgment with the fact that she said, I am running as a progressive Democrat, her exact words is, I will not espouse to any conservative issues. She said this the day after she won the primary. You can't run away from the fact that she is running as a very progressive Democrat. She may try to appear to be running to the center now, and that is why she doesn't want to address what Brian Kemp is saying.
It's going to be, Greg, one of her great challenges in this election is going to be to prove Julianne Thompson wrong, that she is not running to the left, that she, in fact, is a centrist candidate. And maybe you could argue that it is Brian Kemp who ran a primary campaign to the far right. Maybe it's what the question we don't talk much about is Brian Kemp going to come back and find a center from which to run. Maybe it's because he doesn't think he needs to.
That might be part of it. And part of the strategy might be, you know, the polarizing part of the strategy, which is energize the Republican conservative voters as much as possible by talking about his policies and by talking about Stacey Abrams, the negatives about Stacey Abrams. But also I asked Brian about that yesterday, and he said, expect some more centrist type, you know, he didn't use the word centrist, I'll use that. But he said, expect this sort of, you know, somewhat of a pivot coming up. They're talking about how to do that. They're talking about maybe whether or not to do that after Labor Day. But with Stacey Abrams, she's kind of trying to do both. I mean, she is still talking about progressive. Today, she talked about gun control again at the education. But she's also doing these
she would say that's not progressive. She would say that's common sense.
Yeah.
But, okay, and I think a majority of Georgians matters. Would agree with her
right.
position.
But Bill, on this very show, before the primary, on this very show, we sat here with people, with Democratic operatives on the other side of the aisle from me, and they and we talked about the fact that Stacey Abrams was running unabashedly as a progressive Democrat.
Right.
I mean, she can't deny it. Right. I mean, she would have to deny own words.
Okay.
Her own statements.
Can I clarify? So I don't. It's not that she says that she's not progressive, but the first of all, there's a primary. A, that's over. But B, what her point is, I am not going to shy away from what I deeply believe in. But she also believes, and she's not wrong on a lot of these things, that if you pulled it, Georgians agree with her.
All right, I'm getting short on
Medicaid,
time.
Education.
Okay.
No campus carry. Okay. These are not radical.
Councilman Khalid tweets us, and he's pointing to you, Julianne. He says, Trump didn't win Reagan Republicans and unionists and protectionists. Hillary lost them, which is why, and this is what Stacey Abrams has to contend with in her own party, which is why milquetoast Democrats like John Ossoff and Ohio's 12th O'Connor keep losing. Their Lori is a liberal Democrat trying to pull Stacey Abrams in his direction, which I don't know that we're going to see a lot of that in Georgia, but there is some of that here, Lori.
Yes, there is. Okay. There is. I mean, I'm more with Elena on this one. I just think when it comes to governance, that's just not going to work. And yeah, I mean, look at the Ohio 12th. Look at the green vote. If the Democrat had gotten the green vote there, they would win. And to me, the Bernie Sanders, you know, left wing of the Democratic Party has got to understand that, they're electing Republicans by not, you know, aligning themselves with moderate Democrats.
All right. I have to stop the conversation. We are completely out of time for today's show. I apologize I didn't get to more of your comments out there as listeners, viewers. But you're out there. You're on Twitter at PoliticsGPB. You're on Facebook Live at GPB News on Facebook. So you can go and see what everybody's talking about if you have a few minutes. I want to mention what we're doing on Friday's show very briefly. Greg, you'll be especially interested in this because your colleague Jim Galloway wrote a column about this. A couple of teachers over at Clemson uncovered millions of tweets which were put out by a Russian troll factory, some right-wing, other left-wing, all designed to manipulate our attitudes and feelings both before, during, and after the 2016 presidential election. It's a fascinating thing. Jim wrote a column about it that you can read online right now. And on Friday, Patrick Warren, who was one of those researchers at Clemson, will be a guest on this show and talk about what they discovered, how the Russians were meddling with your Twitter account, ladies and gentlemen. That's it. We're out of time. Julianne Thompson, Elena Parent, Lori Johnson, Greg Bluestein, thanks so much for being here. We're back on Friday with another Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. See you then.